Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Cold as a November prairie moon. You're as cold as a November prairie moon. You're as cold as a November.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Justin McGoldrich? Y'all like Justin? From Bendigo, Australia, Justin McGoldrick combines love of old-style country with a punk edge. CDs are available for download on iTunes, Amazon, and Rhapsody, and more can be found at jpmcgoldrick.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark has been on bills including blues artists Otis Rush and R.L. Burnside, and rock and blues artist Johnny Winter. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Little Rock painter Jim Jolly with this piece right over here entitled Rocky 11, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Jim at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our stories all involve our riders and animal interactions, the good, the bad, and the ugly. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Dennis Berry and the neighborhood animals have a standoff, and we'll end the night with William Elkins and a house pet he never saw coming. But let's start the night with Olivia Goza, summer camp, and a slippery, slimy encounter in Outdoor Living Skills.
The list of campers signed up for my Outdoor Living Skills course at Camp Mitchell included 10 junior high boys and one girl. While the campers ate their afternoon snacks, I pulled aside my fellow counselor, Greg, and asked him what he had in mind for initiating our campers into the sweaty, sticky, itchy outdoors. He suggested beginning with an afternoon of fishing. Now, I like to consider myself outdoorsy, but not in the tree-hugging, granola-eating, wearing socks with sandals kind of way. After spending so many summers as a camp counselor on Pettigean Mountain in Arkansas, the outdoors has easily become a big part of my life. I've endured my fair share of chigger, mosquito, and spider bites, and I gave up long ago feeling embarrassed about the sweat stains under my armpits. Sweat is the uniform of a camp counselor. However, there are parts of the outdoors that I have never been fully able to embrace, namely anything categorized under slimy. Therefore, it was with nerves, disguised as confidence, that I agreed with Greg on the fishing excursion. When snack time ended, I took the leftover popsicles back to the kitchen and exchanged them with some old hot dogs, which would serve as fish bait. Incidentally, hot dogs are a best friend to someone who gets queasy at the thought of touching, much less hooking, live bait. Campers were instructed to choose a fishing pole and stand along the edge of the pond, where they would wait as I came around with a bag of hot dogs. Weenie lady, I was called. As I baited each hook, secretly and cunningly putting just enough on the end so as to be nibbled off by the little brim fish before the larger catfish had a chance to plunge and greedily take the hook for themselves. as I was baiting my third hook, I heard the familiar splashing and those dreaded words. I got one! Damn. Too much weenie on hook number one. The camper brought his catch to shore and set the catfish on the muddy ground next to the water. I walked over, eyeing the disgusting creature as it flopped and warbled its catfish song, its whiskers becoming more visible the closer I got. I hope you have a plan for how to get that off, I challenged the boy, not giving a hint that my stomach was turning, unable to commit to feeling nervous or nauseous, as I recalled an eerily similar scene. It was almost a year earlier to the date. Same pond, different group of campers. Same splashing sound, as a camper had stood holding a bent fishing pole. On the opposite end of the line dangled a small brim, but size had nothing to do with my insistence on avoiding skin-to-scale contact. After the camper dropped the less-than-palm-sized fish on the ground, I walked over, pretending like I had everything under control. Maybe if I held the fish down with my foot, I could retract the hook from its lip and let it flop back towards the pond. This proved an effective method for unhooking the little brim, as I narrowly avoided the slime around its gulping mouth. However, no such flop followed. As I knelt, it gave one last convulsion and threw up what I can only suspect were guts and brain onto my shin. As a reflex and subconsciously getting revenge, I kicked the sucker back to where it came from. There it floated atop the water, while the campers behind me began a chorus of amazing grace, mocking both the fish and me. Surely this time would be different. These were junior high boys, and to my knowledge, that meant they lived and loved and breathed disgusting things. I hesitated next to the catfish, hoping one of the boys would step up so I could avoid becoming a repeat offender, fish murderer. But to my disappointment, the boys proved just as squeamish as I was, of course, not letting on to be. If it hadn't have been for Greg and his gloves and pliers, we might still be standing there on the bank staring at the catfish, hoping it would hop off the hook and somersault dive back into the pond. 2 days later, Greg and I took our campers on an overnight camping trip. Whether or not the county was under a mandatory burn ban, I wasn't sure, but because of the lack of rain and the triple-digit heat index in the last month, it was safe to assume we were. Paying absolutely no heed to this evidence, and dwelling instead on the fact that camping means campfire, I scanned the ground for twigs while Greg stacked logs in a teepee shape. While the campers might have been more impressed with us rubbing sticks together to produce a flame, I am no caveman. Pass the bug spray, I demanded, and after dousing the wood and then Greg conjuring a lighter from nowhere, the group's faces were soon illuminated by an orange glow. The sparks that landed next to my feet whispered up at me, "Burn ban." But I simply returned the threat by eyeing the water cooler a few feet away. As the campers stood around the fire, one boy, Sawyer, began shaking his hips and hopping up and down, leading the others in what he called a bear dance. Next to me, Turner stood, leaning against a walking stick which he had found the day before, howling like a coyote. Meanwhile, James waved his arms above the fire while making some whoosh sound. It's possible that these antics were the side effects from breathing in too much of the fire's bug spray fumes. But nonetheless, we created a circle of animals, the line distinguishing ourselves from the natural world growing increasingly thin. Greg and I stood amid the campers, together joking about playing the role of mom and dad to our 11 animal cubs. We were all infected by the excitement of being under the open, star-struck sky, secluded from the rest of camp, where the other campers lay asleep in their bunks, their cabin fans drowning out any sound that might drift over from our campsite. Those kids had probably signed up for arts and crafts. Weenies. Looking at my watch, I realized it was well past midnight, and since bedtime was technically supposed to be at 10:30, I suggested we go to our tents. We took turns dumping cups of our drinking water over the fire. That was never supposed to happen. Any thirst issues would have to wait until morning when we got back to camp. Before crawling into my tent, I sprayed the flap with bug spray, which didn't go unnoticed by the girl camper. "Got enough there?" she asked. "Whatever, Amelia, you caught a turtle while fishing," I jokingly snapped back. With a rock jabbing in my back, I lay between my blanket and the tent floor, looking up and knowing that only a piece of canvas separated me from the starry sky above. The cicadas chirped softly in the surrounding woods. A mosquito hummed past my ear. And I rolled my eyes and smiled as the boys in the neighboring tents challenged one another to see who could produce the loudest flatulent noise with their mouth. As nature's noises lulled me to sleep, I thought about the day ahead. We would wake up and walk back to camp, where I'd take a shower to remove all the bug spray, sweat, and smoke. A clean shirt would hardly last past the morning's activities, and by noon, the sweat stains were liable to reappear. Then I remembered that the cafeteria was scheduled to serve fish sticks for lunch. Gross.
Olivia Goza is a senior at Hendricks College and doesn't have an answer yet for what are you doing after you graduate? Ideally, it might include her interest in rap music, breakfast foods, or online shopping. She is open to suggestions. Next, Dennis Berry unknowingly gets stuck in a battle for territory in A Tale of Black and White.
Just over a year ago, our peaceful suburban life took a turn for the worse. My wife and I began finding hummingbird feeder bottles that knocked off their trees or hooks, and suet cages down on the ground and emptied. In one case, a missing cage was located a few weeks later, about 20 feet up a walnut tree. We had tried to be good neighbors to all around us, both humans and wildlife, but things had been falling apart for the past 2 years. The first day my new wife moved into my home in Bryant, she heard noises coming from underneath her bathtub in the bathroom in the south end of our house, 60 feet from my bathroom, where there were no such disturbances. She even felt movement through the side of the fiberglass tub. She was not overjoyed, to say the least. So I tried to deal with the problem by trapping and relocating any wayward animals. We were fairly sure that the noisy intruder was a possum. More accurately, it was a succession of possums, since the first 9 critters trapped and relocated were all of that species. No raccoons were trapped, but I knew there were raccoons in the vicinity. I had seen them from time to time crossing, or that had been unsuccessful at crossing, a street which runs through a stretch of woods near the house. A sizable creek makes it favorable territory for wildlife, including foxes and deer. Of course, squirrels and rabbits are common in our neighborhood, though we never trapped any. We also had been coming in last in the annual race to harvest the corn and sunflower seeds in our garden. This was no big deal, though, since we don't rely on our garden for basic vegetable needs. Once before, an intruding animal had died under that end of the house. I had come home one July day to find the whole end of the house buzzing with blowflies and reeking of death. The flies stopped coming after a week or so, but the aroma hung around a lot longer. No corpse was ever found, and the annual pest control and termite inspection never revealed even a skeleton. The aluminum covers on the foundation vents were no proof against determined critters, as we found out, but there was no real likelihood of serious damage. It seemed that further action was not absolutely necessary, and the faulty opening remained incompletely sealed. The subfloor residents could come and go as they wanted. We lived in harmony for 2 years, but then came the discovery of the missing suet cage in the walnut tree. Suspecting this to be raccoon-associated, I set a trap using some fish parts for bait. Sure enough, we were awakened just after 1 a.m. by harsh chittering noises. The flashlight beam showed a young raccoon in the trap and its highly agitated mother and ringtail siblings raising a ruckus. One of the small coons lacked a tail but did not lack for lung power. Since it would have been impossible to sleep with the racket they were making, I turned on the outside floodlight and opened the door. The raccoon family scattered, and I released the young coon. It promptly climbed a large cedar tree by the garage, and we retreated into the house, but kept watch for a while. The mother coon returned, called the treed youngster down from its perch, and they all left for the night. The raids on the feeders and the garden soon resumed, but by changing the feeders' locations and giving up the vegetable garden to the summer's heat, we struck an uneasy truce. But the word was out among the visitors of the night. The game was afoot. I set the trap occasionally just to keep the raccoons aware they weren't welcome, and they lived up to their intelligent and voracious reputation after that. Bates would be dragged out the side of the trap, which was often turned on its side, but no more raccoons were caught. The trapping program is presently on hold for the foreseeable future. It seems that there has been a significant increase in the local skunk population, with at least one woods kitty taking up determined residence beneath our house. The first skunk, which apparently never found the vulnerable vent, was trapped within hours of first appearing to my wife. It startled her when it wandered up the driveway one dark night. I poo-pooed her description of it and tried to calm her down. Skunks absolutely do not grow that large, I said. But I set the trap, and morning light revealed a huge mass of skunk and clawed up dirt, practically filling the trap. I had no idea skunks grew that large, but my wife wasted no time reminding me of her previous description. I told you how big it was. It couldn't even begin to turn around in the trap, especially with the dirt and grass it had removed from our lawn. Managing to avoid the skunk's rear artillery, which my nose told me was already partly discharged, I raised the trap door, wedged it open with a stick, and beat a hasty retreat. Within seconds, the skunk headed north toward the creek bottoms not far away. We haven't seen him again, thankfully, but we have since trapped another smaller relative. Two times, regrettably, neither time intended. I had attempted to set up a barricade at the foundation vent. I wanted to make it small enough to prevent an animal from entering, but able to allow the exit of whatever might still be under the house. Upon hearing another subfloor intruder, my wife prevailed upon me to set the trap by the hummingbird feeder in front of the house. The morning light brought, you guessed it, a skunk, but only about half the size of the earlier monster. This one was extremely agitated, agile, and able to maneuver and aim his rear guns. But somehow I was again able to avoid direct contact with the spray. The problem was that he or she was determined to get back underneath the house, and I hadn't sealed up the opening. The blasted animal beat me to it. It was time to take a more strategic approach. I was in no hurry to confront the skunk again, but my wife wanted to try peanut butter marshmallow bait in the trap. Well, it worked, and the same skunk was back in the trap, even more agitated. Aha, I thought, I will block the opening and release the skunk, which will have no way to get under the house, but will have to depart the premises. I barricaded the vent, laid a large black trash bag over the trap, and quickly wedged the trap door open. Yes, the best laid plans. But again, the skunk beat me to the door, to its house. It refused to leave, even as I flung walnut after walnut at the barricade, even bouncing a couple off the undeterred skunk's rear end, only to watch it spray again and again as it clawed its way under the barricade. It was through the vent in less time than it takes to tell about it. The animal has resumed its residence, the yard still reeks, and we are in an uneasy truce. At present, murder is being contemplated.
Dennis Berry, originally from Mena, Arkansas, is a retired microbiologist epidemiologist from the State Health Department. He communes with nature, reads, and occasionally writes in Bryant, Arkansas. He is married, has 8 grandchildren, and volunteers as a tutor with the Literacy Action of Central Arkansas. None of his children has spent a whole night in jail. In our final story of the night, William Elkins moves, but much to his surprise, an unlikely animal comes with him in Henny Penny.
The day had finally come to move from our very small farmhouse on my in-law's 20 acres in central Arkansas to the heart of the big city, North Little Rock. After packing a few of the things in my old Suburban and sitting in the driveway waiting for my wife Irene to join me, that's when she stepped out onto the porch and put up one finger. "Just a minute," she said. What in the world did she forget, I thought. As she disappeared into the house, she came back through the screen door, slamming it behind her. She appeared with our one-legged chicken named Henny Penny. Not in a cage, but in her arms. "What?" I said. I reopened the car door and sat down. Of course she's coming with us. I'm not leaving my new best friend. Off we go. Well, you see, I moved to Arkansas about 12 years ago with my wife, Irie, who is known to everybody in North Little Rock as Hun. But both of us, in our early 50s at the time, had lived in Texas and then the mountains of Colorado before we ended up here living in Arkansas with her mom on beautiful rolling meadows with thick pines, a small pond with jumping bass and catfish, cypress and streams in an old barn, flocks of deer, and plenty of critters to cover the land. However, as everyone knows, particularly you men, living with mother-in-law only lasts so long. So my wife's brother came up with a great idea. He had a little farmette down the road, that is a small house on 20 acres in the city limits, but covered with farm animals. If we would go there, take care of the animals, and watch over the place, well, he would see to it that they take care of our rent, shall we say. Sounded like a deal I couldn't refuse. Turns out the 20 acres were primarily dirt, dotted with a cute little farmhouse, and of course there were all those animals to take care of. 6 goats, 4 horses, 20 chickens, 4 roosters, etc., etc. Now, if you know anything about farming, you know that 4 roosters create plenty of havoc for just 20 hens. On top of all this, my brother-in-law dropped off in the first week we were there 2 orphan foals, 1 week old, the other 10 days old. My wife, being the person she is, fed both of those little colts around the clock, which meant that every 4 hours, she was up with a bottle. The alarm went off at midnight, 4 a.m., 8 a.m., etc. Well, I thought nursing babies years earlier was quite a chore, but holding a bottle and feeding 2 little colts, on the other hand, well, when they didn't have a mama, you wanted to cry and scream at the same time. This really wasn't exactly what I was bargaining for, but life in the Ozarks, woo pig suey. All this is where Henny Penny comes in. You see, the biggest surprise was not the number of animals nor feeding the foals, but the one-legged chicken. Henny was bought by her brother at a sale barn and brought to the farmette to see if she could handle farm life. This small game hen stood no more than 8 inches high, was reddish brown with a little red comb, and one of her lower legs was missing up to the first joint. She would stand there on one leg and hop around, looking at you with those little pinwheel eyes as looks saying to you, "Poor, poor, pitiful me." When you would walk towards her, she would squat down, flush her body out on the ground, and lean forward, hoping you would rescue her from the barnyard mob and pick her up. And did she ever love to be picked up? My goodness, she would sit there calmly in your arms, either by moving her little head around and watching where you were taking her, or tuck her head down and put it underneath your arm. Finally, you know, looking at her, she just tugged at your heartstrings all the way along. And as Irie said one day to me, well, she, being a woman of faith, had asked that God would make her her best friend. And guess what? That's exactly what happened. Now, friends, that's the kind of faith we all need, right? Shoo, shoo, y'all get away from here. Get away, Irie would yell at the other hens and roosters at feeding time, till she and Henny were there by themselves, just staring affectionately at each other. Then extending... Yeah, it's too much, isn't it? Then extending her hand, Irie would feed her grain by grain till every little morsel was gone. Upon completion of the meal, it was Irie's custom then to pick Henny up, bring her inside the house, shall we say, for some afternoon tea. Well, this went on day after day, at least a couple of times a day. Hay for the horses, trash for the goats, feed for the hens, and yes, that special feeding for Henny Penny. What a love affair. But all good things must come to the end. So when we got the chance to move to Indian Hills in North Little Rock, let's just say I was more than happy to leave the country behind us. That is until I re-brought Henny along. Oh, I know, I could have handled a new pet, but the living arrangement with this one was a little bit hard to swallow. I assumed, of course, that, you know, Henny would reside in a cage in the backyard or in the garage. Oh, no, not with Irie. That's way too conventional. Henny became a free-range chicken in the house. Now, don't get me wrong. When it's time to roost, she had a little cage by our bed where she hopped into and was covered with a sheet by Irie. But during the day, she just clucked around the house, the living room, the kitchen, the den, really wherever she wanted, like any normal pet. When, if that wasn't enough, when it was time to run an errand in the car, well, of course, she came with us. And, of course, in the car, she free-ranged, too. Now, that, of course, included my Rottweiler, Gus, on whose back she rode while peering out the rear window. Of course, the highlight of the free-ranging was not what you would expect, which I won't talk about. Except you can imagine a 50-year-old woman regularly going behind a chicken and cleaning up its mess as if it were an infant simply crawling around the house without a diaper. The real entertainment came when Penny would get underneath something like a table or hop into a wastebasket, cluck a few times, lay an egg, and Irie would look at me adoringly and say, "Oh, isn't she sweet, Bill? She just laid an egg for you." As a result of having a free-range chicken in my car, Henny, of course, became very famous in North Little Rock. Just about a year ago, 7 years after her passing, we drove through the local McDonald's. After placing our order of senior coffees and a sausage biscuit, driving up to the pickup window, the woman said, "Oh, I remember you. You used to come in here all the time with that one-legged chicken." Irie replied, "Oh, yes, darling Henny Penny, wasn't she great?" Well, I won't comment on her passing. It's too painful for Irie to even think about. And all of our friends that knew Henny Penny agreed, we will just keep the memory alive of our experiences with her. The free-ranging, the cruising, the egg-laying, the chuckling. Yes, we'll treasure her forever. So that's the saga of Henny Penny. Thinking about it, I don't know if it's a story about the hen, Irie, my wife, or me. But, you know, really, in all likelihood, it's about all of us and really about love. Isn't that what all wonderful stories are about? Thank you.
William Bill Elkins is a senior graduate student at UALR in rhetoric and writing with 25 years experience teaching theology and personal growth issues and 20 years experience in business as a consultant, broker, and fundraiser for profit, nonprofit, and political causes. He lives in Little Rock with his wife of 18 years on property his wife's family homesteaded 100 years ago. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
We're some middle-aged guys. I think we're about as sexy as a dead fish, but this is our sexy song. Darling, come over here and sit beside me. So long since I fell out this and honey.
much in my life. Shed your skin and let me feel the coolness of your body. Step in your room, we'll burn down everything that's holy. Leave your past and your dress on the floor. Everyone's talking about us anyway. So come on, little darling, come over here, sit beside me. It's so long since I felt like this, and I need you to remind me the tension's gone on too long. Dress on the floor.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.